And that night, as John and Maya made love in John's Rover bed, John pulled up from her briefly and looked down at her white body and thought, "So much for political power, Frank, buddy." That deadpan look had told it all. The fierce desire for Maya still there, still burning. Frank, like most of the men in the caravanserai that night, would have loved to have been in John's place at that moment. Once or twice in the past he no doubt had been, but not when John was around. No, tonight Frank would be reminded what real power was made of. Distracted by such nastiness, it took John a while to pay any real attention to Maya herself. It had been almost 5 years since he and she had slept together, and in the intervening time he had had several other partners and knew she had lived for a time with an engineer in Hellas. It was strange to begin again, as they knew each other intimately and yet didn't. Her turning face flickering under him in the dim light, sister, then stranger. Sister, then stranger. Something happened, then something turned in him. All that exterior business fell away, all those games. Something in her face, and the way she was all there, the way she would give her whole self to him when they made love. He didn't know anyone else who was quite like that. And thus the old flame sparked again. Uncertainly at first, as it hadn't been there at all in their first lovemaking, but then, after an hour's quiet talk, they had started kissing and rolled together, and suddenly it was ablaze, and they were inside it. Lit up by Maya, as usual, he had to admit it. She made him pay attention. Sex for her was not, as it tended to be for John, some kind of extension of sport. It was a grand passion to her, a transcendent state of being, and she was so tigerish when she got going that she always surprised him, woke him up, brought him up to her level, reminded him what sex could be. And it was wonderful to be reminded again, to learn that again, really wonderful. Omegendorf was nothing to it. How could he have forgotten? Why did he keep wandering away from her as if she weren't somehow irreplaceable? He crushed her with a hug, and they twisted together, bit at each other, panted and moaned, came together as they had so often before, Maya pulling him over the edge with her. Their ritual. And even afterward, just talking, he somehow felt very much more fond of her. He had started things just to work, Frank, it was true. He had been completely careless of her. But now, lying beside her, he could feel how much he had missed her presence in the previous 5 years, how bland life had seemed, how much he had missed her. New feelings, they always surprised him. He kept assuming he was too old for them, that he had more or less stopped changing, and then something would happen. And so often that something, thinking back over the years, was a meeting with Maya. She was still the same Maya Toitovna, however, mercurial, full of her own thoughts and plans, full of herself. She had no idea what John was doing out there on the dunes, and would never think to ask. And she would slash him to ribbons if he accidentally crossed her mood. He could tell that just in the sultry set of her shoulders, just in the way she padded off to the toilet. But he knew all that already. It was old news, something from the first years at Underhill's so long ago. And the sheer familiarity of it was pleasing. Even her irritability was pleasing, like Frank and his scorn. Well, he was getting old, and they were family. He almost laughed. He almost said something to set her off, then thought better of it. Just knowing was enough. No need for another demonstration, Lord. At that thought he did laugh, and she smiled to hear it, and came back to bed and shoved him in the chest. "Laughing at me again, I see. Because of my fat bottom, is it?" "You know your bottom is perfect." She shoved him again, insulted at what she considered a gross lie, and their wrestling drew them back into the reality of skin and salt, into the world of sex. At some point in the long, lazy session he found himself thinking, "I love you, wild Maya, I really do." It was a disconcerting thought, a dangerous thought. not something he would risk saying. But it felt true. So a couple of days later, when she left to visit the Acheron group and asked him to join her there, he was pleased. Maybe in a couple of months. No, no. Her face was serious. Come sooner. I want you there with me sooner. And when he agreed on a whim, she grinned like a girl with a secret. You won't be sorry. With a kiss, she was off, driving south to Burroughs to catch the train west. After that, there was less chance than ever of learning anything from the Arabs. He had offended Frank, and the Arabs closed ranks behind their friend, as was only right. Hidden colony, they said. What was that? He sighed and gave up on it and decided to leave. Stalking his rover the night before his departure, the Arabs were punctilious about filling his hold with supplies. He pondered what he had accomplished so far in his investigation of the sabotages. So far, Sherlock Holmes was in no danger, that was sure. Worse than that, there was now a whole society on Mars that was basically impenetrable to him. Moslems, what were they exactly? He read Pauline that evening after he was done stalking, and then he rejoined his hosts and watched them as closely as he was able, asking questions all that night long. He knew asking questions was the key to people's souls, infinitely more useful than wit. But in this case, it didn't seem to make any difference. Coyote? Some kind of wild dog, was it? Baffled, he left the caravan the next morning and drove west on the southern border of the Dune Sea. It would be a long journey to Acheron to join Maya, 5,000 kilometers of dune after dune. But he preferred driving to going down to Burroughs and taking the train. He needed time to think. And really, it was a habit now, driving cross-country or flying gliders, getting away, traveling slowly across the land. He had been on the road for years now, crisscrossing the northern hemisphere and making long excursions into the south, inspecting moholes or doing favors for Sachs or Helmut or Frank, or looking into things for a Cadi, or cutting ribbons at the opening of one thing or another, a town, a well, a weather station, a mine, a mohole, and always talking, talking in public speeches or private conversations, talking to strangers, old friends, new acquaintances, talking almost as fast as Frank did, and all in an attempt to inspire the people on the planet to figure out a way to forget history, to build a functioning society, to create a scientific system designed for Mars, designed to their specifications, fair and just and rational and all those good things, to point the way to a new Mars. And yet after every year that passed, it seemed less likely to happen the way he had envisioned it. A place like Bradbury Point showed how rapidly things were changing, and people like the Arabs confirmed the impression. Events were out of his control, and more than that, out of anyone's control. There was no plan. He rolled west on autopilot, up and down over dune after dune, not seeing a thing, sunk deep in an attempt to understand what exactly history was and how it worked. And it seemed to him as he drove on day after day that history was like some vast thing that was always over the tight horizon, invisible except in its effects. It was what happened when you weren't looking. An unknowable infinity of events which, although out of control, controlled everything. After all, he had been here from the very beginning. He had been the beginning, the first person to step on this world, and then he had returned against all the odds and helped to build it from scratch. And yet now, despite all that, it was spinning away from him. Contemplating that fact made him tense with disbelief and sometimes with a sudden furious frustration. To think that the whole thing was accelerating not only beyond his control, but even beyond his ability to comprehend. It wasn't right. He had to fight it. And yet how? Social planning of some sort. Clearly they had to have it. This flailing about without a plan, in violation of even the flimsy plan people had made back at the beginning with the Mars Treaty. Well, societies without a plan, that was history so far. But history so far had been a nightmare, a huge compendium of examples to be avoided. No, they needed a plan. They had a chance at a new start here. They needed a vision. Helmut, the oily functionary, Frank, with his cynical acceptance of the status quo, his acceptance of the breakdown of the treaty as if they were in a kind of gold rush, Frank was wrong. Wrong as usual. But his own rushing about was probably wrong, too. He had been operating on the unarticulated theory that if he only saw more of the planet, visited one more settlement, talked to one more person, that he would somehow, without really thinking too hard, get it, and that his holistic understanding would then flow back from him to everybody else, spreading out through all the new settlers and changing things. Now he was pretty sure that this feeling had been naive. There were so many people on the planet these days, he could never hope to connect with them, to become the articulator of all their hopes and desires. And not only that, but few of the newcomers seemed much like the first 100 in regard to their reasons for coming. Well, that wasn't entirely true. There were still scientists coming up, and people like the Swiss road-building gypsies, but he didn't know them like he did the first 100, and he never would. That little band had formed him, really. They had shaped his opinions and ideas, had taught him. They were his family. He trusted them. And he wanted their help. He needed it now more than ever. Perhaps it was this which explained the sudden new intensity of his feeling for Maya, and perhaps it was this which made him so angry with Hiroko. He wanted to talk to her. He needed her help. And she had abandoned them. Vlad and Ursula had relocated their biotech complex to a fin-like ridge in the Acheron Fosse, a narrow prominence which looked like the conning tower of a vast submerged submarine. They had honeycombed the upper part of it with excavations that extended from cliff to cliff. Some of the rooms were a kilometer wide and glass-walled on both sides. The windows on the south side had a view of Olympus Mons, some 600 kilometers away. North-facing windows looked down onto the pale tan sands of Arcadia Planitia. John drove up a wide ledge to the bottom of the fin and plugged into the garage locked door, noticing as he did that the ground in the narrow canyon south of the settlement was lumpy with heaps of what appeared to be melted brown sugar. "It's a new kind of cryptogamic crust," Vlad said when John asked him about it. "A symbiosis of cyanobacteria and Florida platform bacteria. The platform bacteria goes very deep and converts sulfates in the rock to sulfides, which then feed a variant of microcoleus. The top layers of that grow in filaments, which bind to sand and clay in big dendritic formations, so it's like little forest sylvanols with really long bacterial root systems. It looks like these root systems will keep on going right down through the regolith to bedrock, melting the permafrost as they go." "And you've released this stuff?" John said. "Sure. We need something to bust up the permafrost, right?" "Is there anything to stop it from growing planet-wide?" "Well, it has the usual array of suicide genes in case it begins to overwhelm the rest of the biomass, but if it keeps to its niche..." "Wow. It's not too unlike the first life forms that covered the Terran continents, we think. We've just enhanced its speed of growth and its root systems. The funny thing is that I think at first it's going to cool the atmosphere, even though it's warming things underground, because it'll really increase chemical weathering of the rock, and all those reactions absorb CO2 from the air, so the air pressure is going to drop." Maya had come up and joined them with a big hug for John, and now she said, "But won't the reactions release oxygen as fast as they absorb CO2 and keep air pressure up?" Vlad shrugged. "Maybe. We'll see." John laughed. "Sax is a long-term thinker. He'll probably be pleased." "Oh, yes. He authorized the release, and he's coming to study here again when spring comes." They had dinner in a hall located high on the fin, just under the crest. Skylights opened above to the greenhouse on the crest itself, and windows ran the length of the north and south walls. Stands of bamboo filled the walls to east and west. All the residents of Acheron were there for dinner, holding to an Underhill custom as they did in many other ways. The discussion at John and Maya's table ranged widely, but kept returning to the current work, which involved trying to solve problems caused by the need to implant safeguards in all the gems they were releasing. Double suicide genes in every gem was a practice the Acheron group had initiated on its own, and it was now going to be codified as UN law. "That's all well and good for legal gems," Vlad said. "But if some fools try something on their own and blow it, we could be in big trouble anyway." After dinner, Ursula said to John and Maya, "Since you're here, you ought to get your physicals. It's been a while for both of you." John, who hated physicals and indeed all medical attention of any kind, demurred. But Ursula hounded him, and eventually he gave in and visited her clinic a couple of days later. There he was put through a battery of diagnostic tests that seemed even more intensive than usual, most of them run by imaging machines and computers with two relaxing voices, telling him to move this way and then that, while John, in complete ignorance, did what he was told. Modern medicine. But after all that, he was poked and prodded and tapped in time-honored fashion by Ursula herself, and when it was over, he was lying on his back with a white sheet over him, while she stood at his side, looking at readouts and humming absently. "You're looking good," she told him after several minutes of that. "Some of the usual gravity-related problems, but nothing we can't deal with." "Great," John said, feeling relieved. That was the thing about physicals. Any news was bad news. One wanted an absence of news. Getting that was somehow a victory, and more so every time, but still a negative accomplishment. Nothing had happened to him. Great. "So do you want the treatment?" Ursula asked, her back to him, her voice casual. "The treatment?" "It's a kind of gerontological therapy, an experimental procedure, somewhat like an inoculation, but with a DNA strengthener. Repairs broken strands and restores cell division accuracy to a significant degree." John sighed. "And what does that mean?" "Well, you know, ordinary aging is mostly caused by cell division error. After a number of generations, ranging from hundreds to tens of thousands, depending which kind of cells you're talking about, errors in reproduction start to increase and everything gets weaker. The immune system is one of the first to weaken, and then other tissues, and then finally something goes wrong, or the immune system gets overwhelmed by a disease, and that's it." "And you're saying you can stop these errors?" "Slow them down, anyway, and fix the ones that are already broken. A mix, really. The division errors are caused by breaks in DNA strands, so we wanted to strengthen DNA strands. To do it, we would read your genome and then build an auto-repair genomic library of small segments that will replace the broken strands." "Auto-repair?" She sighed. "All Americans think that's funny. Anyhow, we push this auto-repair library into the cells where they bind to the original DNA and help keep them from breaking." She began to draw double and quadruple helixes as she talked, shifting inexorably into biotech jargon, until John could only catch the general drift of the argument, which apparently had its origins in the Genome Project and the field of genetic abnormality correction, with application methods taken from cancer therapy and GEM technique. Aspects of these and many other different technologies had been combined by the Acheron group, Ursula explained, and the result seemed to be that they could give him an infection of bits of his own genome, an infection which would invade every cell in his body except for parts of his teeth and skin and bones and hair. And afterward, he would have nearly flawless DNA strands, repaired and reinforced strands that would make subsequent cell division more accurate. "How accurate?" he asked, trying to grasp what it all meant. "Well, about like if you were 10 years old." "You're kidding." "No, no. We've all done it to ourselves back around LS-10 of this year, and so far as we can tell, it's working.
Does it last forever?
Nothing lasts forever, John. How long, then? We don't know. We ourselves are the experiment. We figure we'll find out as we go along. It seems possible we might be able to do the therapy again when the rate of division error begins to increase again. If that is successful, it could mean you would last for quite a while.
Like how long? He insisted.
Well, we don't know, do we? Longer than we live now, that's pretty sure. Possibly a lot longer.
John stared at her.
She smiled at the expression on his face, and he could feel that his jaw was slack with amazement. No doubt he looked less than brilliant, but what did she expect? It was...
He was following his thoughts with difficulty as they skittered around.
Who have you told about this? He asked.
Well, we have asked everyone in the first 100 when they get a checkup with us, and everyone here at Acheron has tried it. And the thing is, we've only combined methods that everyone has, so it won't be long before others try putting it all together, too. So we're writing it up for publication, but we're going to send the articles first to be reviewed by the World Health Organization. Political fallout, you know.
Hmm, John said, considering it. News of a longevity drug loose on Mars, back among the teeming billions. My lord, he thought.
Is it expensive?
Not extremely. Reading your genome is the most expensive part, and it takes time. But it's just a procedure, you know. It's just computer time. It's very possible you could inoculate everyone on Earth, but the population problem down there is already critical as it is. They'd have to institute some pretty intense population control, or else they'd go Malthusian really fast. We thought we'd better leave the decisions to the authorities down there.
But word is sure to get out.
Is that true? They might try to put a clamp on it. Maybe even a comprehensive clamp, I don't know.
Wow. But you folks, you just went ahead and did it?
We did, she shrugged.
So what do you say? Want to do it?
Let me think about it.
He went for a walk on the crest of the Fin, up and down the long greenhouse stuffed with bamboo and food crops. Walking west, he had to shield his eyes from the glare of the afternoon sun, even through the filtered glass. Walking back east, he could look out at the broken slopes of lava stretching up to Olympus Mons. It was hard to think. He was 66 years old, born in 1982, and what was it back on Earth now? 2048? M11. 11 long, high-rad Martian years. And he had spent 35 months in space, including 3 trips between Earth and Mars, which was still the record. He had taken on 195 REMs in those trips alone, and he had low blood pressure and a bad HDL to LDL ratio, and his shoulders ached when he swam and he felt tired a lot. He was getting old. He didn't have all that many years left, weird though it was to think of it. And he had a lot of faith in the Acheron group who, now that he thought of it, were wandering around their airy, working and eating and playing soccer and swimming and so on, with little smiles of absorbed concentration, with a kind of humming. Not like 10-year-olds, certainly not, but with an aura of suffused, absorbed happiness, of health, and more than health. He laughed out loud and went back down to Acheron looking for Ursula. When she saw him, she laughed too. It's not really that hard a choice, is it? No.
He laughed with her.
I mean, what have I got to lose?
So he agreed to it. They had his genome in their records, but it would take a few days to synthesize the collection of repair strands and clip them into plasmids and clone millions more. Ursula told him to come back in 3 days. When he got back to the guest rooms, Maya was already there, looking as shocked as he felt, wandering nervously from dresser to sink to window, touching things and looking around as if she had never seen such a room before. Vlad had told her about it after her physical, just as Ursula had with John.
"Immortality plague!" she exclaimed, and laughed strangely. "Can you believe it?"
"Longevity plague!" he corrected her. And no, I can't. Not really. He felt a little dizzy, and he could see she hadn't heard him. Her agitation made him nervous. They heated soup, ate in a daze. Vlad had told Maya to come to Acheron and intimated what it was all about. That was why she had insisted that John accompany her to Acheron. When she told him that, he felt a shiver of fondness for her. Standing next to her, washing the dishes, observing her hands shake as she spoke, he felt exceptionally close to her. It was as if they knew each other's thoughts, as if, after all the years, in the face of this bizarre development, there were no need for words, only for each other's presence. That night, in the warm dark of their bed, she whispered hoarsely, "We'd better do it twice tonight, while it's still us." 3 days later, they both got the treatment. John lay back on a medical couch in a small room and stared at an intravenous plug in the back of his hand. An IV feed shot, just like all those he'd had before, except this time he could feel a strange heat rising up his arm, flushing his chest, pouring down his legs. Was it real? Was he imagining it? For a second he felt extremely odd all over, as if his ghost had walked through him. Then he was just very hot. "Should I be this hot?" he asked Ursula anxiously. "It's like a fever at first," she said. "Then we put a small shock through you to push the plasmids into your cells. After that, it's more chills than fever, as the new strands bond to the old. People often feel quite cold, actually." An hour later, a big IV bag had drained into him. He was still hot, and his bladder was full. They let him get up and go to the bathroom. Then when he returned, he was strapped into what looked like a cross between a couch and an electric chair. That didn't bother him. Astronaut training had inured him to all devices. The shock, when it came, lasted about 10 seconds and felt like a disagreeable tickling everywhere in him. Ursula and the others detached him from the apparatus. Ursula, her eyes twinkling, gave him a kiss full on the mouth. She warned him again that in a while he would start to feel chilled, and that it would last for a couple of days. It was okay to sit in the saunas or whirlpool baths. In fact, they recommended it. So he and Maya sat in the corner of a sauna together, huddled in the penetrating warmth, watching the bodies of the other visitors who came in white and went out pink. It seemed to John an image of what was happening to the two of them. Come in 65, go out 10. He really couldn't believe it. It was still very hard for him to think. He found his thoughts simply blanked, his mind stunned. If brain cells were reinforced too, had his clogged unexpectedly? He had always been a ragged, slow thinker. In fact, this was probably no more than his usual obtuseness, brought to his attention because he was trying so hard to come to grips with the thing, to think what it meant. Could it really be true? Could they really be sidestepping death for some years, perhaps some decades? They left the sauna to eat, and after their meals they took short walks in the Crest greenhouse, looking out at the dunes to the north, the chaotic lava to the south. The view north reminded Maya of early Underhill, with the random litter of stones on Luni replaced by Arcadia's windswept quilt pattern of dunes, as if her memory had cleaned up her recollections of that time, making them more patterned, tinting their faded ochres and reds to rich lemon yellows. Patination of the past. He stared at her curiously. It had been 11 years since those first days in the trailer park. And in most of the years since, the two of them had been lovers, with a number of blessed interruptions and separations, of course, caused by circumstances or, more usually, their inability to get along. But they had always started again when the opportunities came, and the upshot was that now they knew each other just about as well as any old married couple with a less interrupted history, perhaps even better. Because any completely constant couple was likely to have stopped paying attention to each other at some point. While the two of them, with all their separations and reunions, fights and rapprochements, had had to relearn each other countless times. John said some of this to her, and they talked about it, It was a pleasure to talk about it. We have had to keep paying attention, Maya said intently, nodding with a look of solemn satisfaction, sure that this was mostly her doing. Yes, they had paid attention. They had never fallen into the mindless rut of habit. Surely, they both agreed as they sat in the baths or walked the crest, this compensated for the time they had spent apart, more than compensated for it. Yes, no doubt they knew each other even better than any old married couple. And so they talked, trying to stitch their pasts to this strange new future, in the anxious hope that it wouldn't prove to be an unbridgeable rupture. And late the following evening, 2 days after the inoculation, sitting alone, naked in the sauna, their flesh still cold, their skin all rosy with sweat, John looked at Maya's body sitting there beside him, as real as a rock, and he felt a glow like the IV injection running all through him. He hadn't eaten much since the treatment, and the beige and yellow tiles they sat on had started to throb, as if lit from within. Light gleamed on every water droplet covering the tiles, like tiny chips of lightning scattered everywhere, and Maya's body sprawled over these sparkling tiles, pulsing before him like a pink candle. The intense there-ness of it. Hyxiety, Sax had called it once, when John had asked him something about his religious beliefs. I believe in hyxiety, Sax had said, in thisness, in here and nowness, in the particular individuality of every moment. That's why I want to know what is this, what is this, what is this? Now, remembering Sax's odd word and his odd religion, John finally understood him, because he was feeling the thisness of the moment, like a rock in his hand, and it felt as if his entire life had been lived only to get him to this moment. The tiles and the thick hot air were pulsing around him, as if he were dying and being reborn, and sure, that was really the case, if what Ursula and Vlad said were true. And there beside him, in the process of being reborn, was the pink body of Maya Toitovna. Maya's body, which he knew better than his own, and not only in this moment, but through time. He could recall vividly his first sight of her naked, floating toward him in the bubble chamber on the Ares, surrounded by a nimbus of stars and the black velvet of space. And every change in her since then was perfectly visible to him. The shift from the image in his memory to the body beside him was a hallucinatory time dissolve. Her flesh and skin shifting, dropping, lining, aging. They were both older, creakier, heavier. That was the way it went. But really the amazing thing was how much had remained, how much they were still themselves. Lines from a poem came to him, the epitaph of the Scott expedition near Ross Station in Antarctica. They had all climbed the hill to see the big wooden cross together, and carved on it had been lines. Much has gone, yet much remains. Something like that. He couldn't remember. Much had gone. It had been a long time ago, after all. But they had worked hard and eaten well, and perhaps Mars's gravity had been kinder than Earth's would have been, because the obvious glowing truth was that Maya Toitovna was still a very beautiful woman, strong and muscly, her imperial face and gray wet hair still commanding his gaze, her breasts still magnets to his eye. Completely different in appearance if she so much as shifted an elbow, and yet in every position completely familiar to him. His breasts, his arms, ribs, flanks. She was, for better and worse, the person he was closest to. A beautiful pink animal, and also an avatar for him, of sex, of life itself on this bare rocky world. If this was what they were at 65, and if the treatment did no more than hold them at this point for even a few added years, or, the shock of it still, for decades? For decades? Well, it was astonishing. Absolutely too much to grasp. He had to stop trying, or he would strip all the gears of his mind. But could it be? Could it really be? The aching desire of all true lovers through all the ages, to have a bit more time together, to be able to stretch out and live the love fully. Similar feelings seemed to be stirring Maya. She was in a great mood. She watched him from hooded eyes with that come-hither half-smile he knew so well, one knee up and tucked in her armpit, not flaunting her sex at him, but just comfortable, relaxing as she would if she were alone. Yes, there was nothing like Maya in a good mood. No one could infect other people with it so much and so surely. He felt a rush of affection for that aspect of her character, an IV of sentiment, and he put a hand on her shoulder and squeezed. Eros, just a spice in a feast of agape. And suddenly, as usual, the words just burst out of him. He said things to her that he had never said before. "Let's get married," he said. And when she laughed, he did too, and said, "No, no, I mean it. Let's get married." Get married and grow really, really old together. Seize whatever gift years came and make them a shared adventure. Have kids. Watch the kids have kids. Watch the grandkids have kids. Watch the great-grandkids have kids. My Lord, who knew how long it might last? They might watch a whole nation of descendants flourish, become patriarch and matriarch, a kind of mini Martian Adam and Eve. And Maya laughed at each declaration, her eyes vivacious and sparkling with affection, windows to a soul in a very, very good mood, watching him and soaking him up. He could feel the blotter tug of her gaze watching him and laughing delightedly at each new absurd, hilarious phrase that burst out of him and saying to him, "Something like that, yes, something like that," and then hugging him hard. "Oh, John," she said, "you know how to make me happy. You are the best man I ever had." She kissed him, and he found that despite the sauna's heat, it was going to be easy to shift the emphasis from agape to eros. But now the two were one, indistinguishable, a great mingled flood of love. "So you'll marry me and all?" he said as he locked the sauna door, and they began to fall into it. "Something like that," she said, eyes flashing, face ablaze, with an absolutely ravishing smile. When you expect to live another 200 years, you behave differently from when you expect to live only 20. This they proved almost immediately. John spent the winter there at Acheron, on the edge of the CO2 fog cap that still descended over the North Pole every winter, studying aerobotany with Marina Takarova and her lab group. He did this on Sax's instruction, and because he felt in no hurry to leave. Sax seemed to have forgotten about the search to find out who the saboteurs were, which made John a little suspicious. In his spare time, he still made efforts through Pauline, concentrating on the areas he had been working on before Acheron, travel records mostly, and then employment records of all the people who had traveled to the areas where the sabotages had taken place. Presumably, there were a lot of people involved, so individual travel records might not tell him much. But everyone on Mars had been sent there by an organization, and by checking which organizations had sent people to the relevant places, he hoped to get some indications. It was a messy business, and he had to rely on Pauline not only for statistics, but advice, which was worrying. The rest of the time he studied a branch of aerobotany in which all the payoffs were at least decades away. Why not? He had the time and might very well see the fruits of the work. So he watched Marina's group design a new tree, studying with them and doing their lab work, washing glassware and the like. The tree was designed to serve as the canopy of a multi-layered forest which they hoped to grow on the dunes of Vastatus borealis. It was based on a sequoia genome, but they wanted trees even bigger than sequoias, perhaps 200 meters tall, with a trunk 50 meters in diameter at the base. Their bark would stay frozen most of the time, and their broad leaves, which would probably look as if they had tobacco leaf disease, were going to be able to absorb the baseline dose of UV radiation without damage to their purplish undersides. At first, John thought the tree's size was excessive, but Marina pointed out that they would be capable of taking in great quantities of carbon dioxide, fixing the carbon and transpiring the oxygen back into the air. And they were going to be quite a sight, or so they supposed. The actual chutes of the competing test prototypes were only 10 meters tall, and it would be 20 years before the winners of the competition reached their mature heights. And right now, all the prototypes still died in Mars jars. Atmospheric conditions would have to change considerably before they would survive outdoors. Marina's lab was getting ahead of the game. But so was everyone else. This seemed to be a result of the treatment. It made sense on the face of it. Longer experiments. Longer, John groaned, investigations. Longer thoughts.